Welcome to Teacher Quit Talk. I'm Miss Redacted.
And I'm Mrs. Frazzled. Every week we explore the teacher exodus to find out what, if anything, could get these educators back in the classroom.
We've all had our moments where we thought, what the hell am I doing here? From burnout to bureaucracy to soul-sucking stressors and creative dead ends.
From recognizing when it was time to go to navigating feelings of guilt and regret afterwards, we're here to cut out the gaslighting and get real about what it means to leave teaching.
We've got insights from former teachers from all over the country who have seen it all. So get ready to be disturbed. Join us on Teacher Quit Talk to laugh through the pain of the U.S. education system. We'll see you there.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
Дамы и господа, это Prevail. И ваш ведущий Грег Олир.
I'm Greg Oliar. This is Prevail. Welcome to the program. We've got a great show today. Rachel Slade is here. Rachel is a journalist and the author of a fantastic book called Into the Raging Sea, 33 Mariners, One Megastorm, and the Sinking of El Faro. She's also written a couple pieces for me at Prevail. So you can go check out her work there. You can go check out my work there. Please subscribe to the Prevail website. We would love that. I know Rachel because she reached out to me right around the time that Ghislaine Maxwell got indicted and arrested because she was with this guy named Scott Borgerson, who is the CEO of Cargometrics, which is a company that involves maritime stuff. We talk about it in the podcast later on. And Scott Borgerson is also either the boyfriend or the husband of Ghislaine Maxwell. And she was like, oh my God. So she called me and I wrote this piece about him right away, like the same week that story broke. And then she came on and wrote a couple more pieces, which are really great. And, you know, the thing about Rachel is she's interested in shipping now because she wrote the book about the shipwreck, which we talk about. And she got me to go down this rabbit hole of shipping. And, you know, honestly, I'm one of these people, I'm like, you go to like Cape Cod or something or down the Jersey Shore and there's these stores that sell like nautical stuff. And I'm always like, my eyes roll in my head. Like I don't care about that at all. But in fact, the more I started to read about all this stuff in the modern era, the more fascinated I became about shipping and logistics and boats and who owns what and how it all works. Because, you know, we get stuff from all over the place. Nothing is made here anymore. We talk about that on the podcast. Also, it comes from elsewhere. How does it get here? It gets here mostly on these ships, in these container ships. So anyway, it's a fascinating subject, and we talk about a lot of fun things, a lot of really interesting things, including the hoodie and how the hoodie, she argues, is the purely quintessential American garment. Now, it is Tuesday, late afternoon, July 20th, as I'm recording this. This is going to release on Friday, of course, and I'm a little bit wary about talking too much, but what happened today is that Tom Barrack got indicted. Tom Barrack, Trump's good friend. Yeah. Tom Barrack, the guy who, according to an article I read today, was such close friends with Trump that he was actually comforting him at Fred Trump's funeral. He's a guy who's been in his ear for years and years. He's the guy that suggested that Trump pick Paul Manafort, their mutual acquaintance, to be his campaign manager. He's mixed up with this UAE stuff. UAE, the United Arab Emirates, that's where Eric Prince hangs out. They are an ally of Saudi Arabia. These guys are working with, apparently, hostile foreign governments, and that's what the indictment is all about. So I'm feeling a little giddy about this, because this guy is, I know most people haven't heard of him so much. He's not somebody that is a name that most people would recognize, but this guy is very, very important, and he is very close to Trump. He's close to Eric Prince through the UAE stuff. He's close to Manafort. He's close to Epstein. There's lots of ties that this guy kind of brings together. And what happens now is going to be very, very interesting. So before we get started, I'm just going to say right out, I've been critical of Merrick Garland. If this is the beginning of something, they're going to take down these people, then I'm just going to shut up about that for at least a week. So, you know, he's done some things that I don't like, but going after this scumbag is really good. This is very good news for justice. Speaking of which, you know, I draw these tarot cards in the morning. One tarot card every morning. I think I talked about this on one of the podcasts. Yeah, the podcast with Asia Raiden. I talked about my stupid and silly belief that I pick these tarot cards every morning. I shit you not, this morning, Tuesday, July 20th, the card that I picked, justice. Swear to God, that was the card I picked. And I guess what that means is that Tom Barrack is going to get indicted and probably going to go to jail. Oh, well, so sad, too bad. So I have no new news on this. I suppose maybe I'll write about him at some point. Maybe we'll do a Man in the Middle Tom Barrack piece, because he seems like he's one of those guys that's in the middle and is occupies that center of the Venn diagram where lots of different things overlap, right? So probably I'm going to get to work on that one of these weeks. But in the meantime, what we're talking about now is the high seas. We're talking about maritime stuff. We're talking about the Jones Act. We're talking about shipping. And there's nobody knows more about shipping than Rachel Slade. This is a really fun conversation. I was fascinated by it. She's really just a wealth of knowledge about a lot of different subjects and really fun to talk to, as you will see. As you will see, as you will hear in the interview right now.
From executive producer Mark Burnett, it's the new non-woke weekend sketch comedy show, Saturday Night Live, starring Kirstie Alley, Scott Baio, Roseanne Barr, Gary Busey, Stacey Dash, Dennis Miller, Dennis Quaid, Kid Rock, Antonio Sabato Jr., Rob Schneider, John Voight, James Woods, featuring Lauren Boebert, Diamonds and Silk, Brett Favre, Marjorie Taylor Greene, a bunch of boxers and ex-pro football players with late-stage CTE, musical guest Lil Pump, and your host, Donald Trump. Ladies and gentlemen, Donald Trump.
Rachel Slade, welcome to the podcast.
Woohoo! Excited to be here.
No, I'm excited to have you. So before we get started, how are you handling the coming out of quarantine? Because I talked to you a couple times during quarantine and you seem to be maybe not handling it so great. I don't know.
Wait, have we come out of quarantine?
In New York, we're effectively out of quarantine. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think that effectively is an important modifier right there. I mean, I'm still, you know, walking around with a mask. And actually, I just spoke to not one, not two, but four people in LA who have had breakthrough cases. So not to be a Debbie Downer or Rachel Downer, but I don't know, Greg. I don't know.
I don't know either. The variants are here and whatever. I tend to, what I do is if I go to a store now and if the people are wearing a mask, I put a mask on. If the people aren't, then I don't. That's basically.
That's very counterintuitive.
Yeah, because I don't want, like, it's weird because now here in upstate New York, which is, you know, we're in a place where it's reasonably safe and we don't have as many dipshits who refuse to get vaccinated. So we're kind of okay and a little bit maybe, you know, better than a lot of places in the country for sure. Yeah. But, you know, the signs say, wear the mask if you're not vaccinated. And I don't want them to think that I'm not vaccinated.
See, now here's the dilemma, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you're walking around, or me in my case, walking around with my mask. And yeah, I look like one of those assholes.
Except
but
that-
I want to like wear a sign that says, yes, I'm vaccinated. No, I'm not one of those assholes. However, I'm not convinced it's over. I'm a paranoid, you know, anxious Eastern European type. And this is what we do.
But I think the counterintuitive of the counterintuitive, I guess, full intuitive then, is that the people that are not vaccinated are also not going to wear a mask. So I guess one can assume that, especially somebody who's older and wearing a mask, is wearing a mask not because they're not vaccinated, but because they're trying to be socially conscious.
Okay, so here's this weird decision tree, right? Because you said that when you go into the store and they're not wearing masks,
yeah,
then you don't.
Right.
Except that if they're not vaccinated, there's no way that they're going to be wearing a mask. So then go back to that decision tree, and maybe we can assume that they're not vaccinated.
That could be, or they just are. And it, you know, it just depends. Again, for me at this point, it's just about politeness and making people feel comfortable.
Right.
Like other people. Like I actually did start wearing the mask again, like inside the stores when this Delta variant starts coming around. Cause I said, I don't know, you know, I don't want to get it because I need mask freedom when I'm buying my like romaine lettuce. Like I can handle
exactly.
wearing the mask for, you know, a few minutes. I wore it into the bank the other day and I thought, do they want me to wear this? You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, we're really in a very bizarre position at this point, but all I have to say is I like my apartment. It's fine. It's been good to me. I think we're going to continue to be close friends, my apartment and I, for the next year or so.
For people listening, which is everybody, because this is not a video, you know, broadcast, you have a very nice apartment. You have cool artwork behind you, which we discussed before hitting the record button. So it is it does look like a pleasant place to while away months and months of not going outside.
Well, thank you. Yes. Yeah, we have enjoyed it. Although I convinced the neighbors upstairs to let us use their apartment for our Zoom meeting spillover. So when there are just too many goddamn people on Zoom calls or whatever in this apartment, by the way, you're hearing my robot feed my cats. I don't know if you can hear that, but then we can spill over upstairs.
Okay, well, that's nice. You know, it's, you know, teamwork makes the dream work. That's what I always say. It's actually never what I say. It's just, I don't know. Is that like on a poster where the cat's claw is coming down and, you know, but that's like, hang on or whatever. That, you know what I'm talking about, that poster.
I do.
Yeah, yeah. I think maybe like Patrick Byrne has that on his wall or somebody like that. What are these, you know, Mike Lindell, I don't know.
Yeah, no, you're talking about those things you used to buy off of Sky Mall, right? Where you would have like a picture of the sunset and it would say leadership and then some nonsense.
I mean, the sun really is a leader because once it goes down, you know, stuff does start to happen. So.
Anarchy.
Yeah. Solar
prevails.
Solar anarchy. Okay. So I want to, first of all, before we get started, I have your book here, which is called Into the Raging Sea. I should read the subtitle also. 33 Mariners, One Megastorm, and the Sinking of El Faro. I have read
Magic
your book.
Freeze.
It's really, really good. I'm not the only one who thinks so, because my copy here has a little decal on it that says a notable book of the year by some little rag called the New York Times Book Review. So I'm not the only one who thinks this. So before we get into all the other stuff we're going to talk about, tell everybody a little bit about that. How did you get interested in that story? How'd you get into ships, man?
You know, I didn't know anything about ships, but I have lived on the East Coast my whole life. And I was born in a big port city, raised in a big port city, went to school in a big port city, and now live in a big port city and all different big port cities. So I think, you know, there was just a part of me that was like connected to the ocean, connected to shipping. And especially here in Boston, where I live now, you know, this is a former port town. And this is really where a lot of, you know, commerce got started. And most of it was via ocean. But, you know, so this book is actually, I'm surprised, but a lot of people don't know that in 2015, so just 6 years ago, the Americans lost a container ship. So an American container ship, and we don't have that many anymore. We have a very small fleet. Sailed out of Jacksonville, Florida, and went right into a hurricane. It was October 1st, 2015, and disappeared. The ship literally disappeared. We lost it for weeks. And there were 33 people aboard. All of those people were lost with the ship. And together, taxpayers, all of us, spent $3 million first to locate that ship and then locate the what's called a voice data recorder on the ship. So this is now 15,000 feet down. They had to find this little coffee can sized data recorder. And then the Coast Guard, working with the National Transportation Safety Board, actually was able to bring that little thing back up to the surface, download the audio. And it turned out that there was 26 hours of conversations captured from the bridge of that ship leading up to the very final moments when the ship went down. So as a journalist, it was just this incredible thing that I had. I would say it's probably the most documented shipwreck in the history of the world. You know, we have obviously shipwrecks starting with Noah, or I guess it wasn't a shipwreck, but I mean, ship stories, you know, we have lots of ship stories over millennia, but none have ever been captured this way before, you know, time stamped every minute, every hour, these conversations of people deliberating, you know, privately aside or with the captain, how to deal with the weather that they were seeing on their screens and they were hearing over the radio and they were getting from the National Weather, the National Hurricane Center. So it's an incredible thing that I had, and I was able to use those conversations, which were transcribed, as well as 6 weeks of hearings that the National Safety Board conducted to put together this book. And, you know, the why, I think people ask me, and it's just like, I could not turn away from this. As soon as I heard that a ship had gone down, you know, in this day and age,
yeah,
a modern ship with satellite communications and, you know, all the weather service forecasting stuff aboard and everything else and all the training that these guys get, you know, $25 million worth of goods on the ship, an American ship, I was riveted. I could not look away. And then the other thing is that, you know, there were 8 people from New England aboard that ship, including 5 from Maine. The captain went to Maine Maritime. I'm here in Boston. I feel very close to Maine. And I was just like, wow, people still make a living on the sea, and they still sometimes lose their lives on the sea. So what is this all about? I just threw myself into it. So that's the long answer, but the short answer is, yeah, I didn't know anything about the Merchant Marine, the American Merchant Marine, or shipping or trade or anything like that. But I got a crash course, and it was a very intense couple of years reporting and writing that book.
It's really a wonderful book. I mean, it's I got chills just listening to you describe it right now, having read the book and coming back to parts of it, and you know, the way that you construct the story and go through and we meet the people that you know that died in the shipwreck, which is really, you're not thinking that that's going to happen, like you said, in this day and age. And it all boils down to like human error and greed and corporate fuck ups and this and that. And it's a big tragedy is what, it, you know, there's no two ways about it, but you did just a wonderful job on a subject that's, you know, difficult to look at because it is so sad and tragic. So also what came out of that experience of reading your book and talking to you was, now I started going down this rabbit hole of ships and shipping, which is, as you know, is completely fascinating. And I want to talk about also how you and I know each other, which is basically, I think I wrote something about Ghislaine Maxwell on my Prevail page, and you reached out to me after it came out that she was with that guy, Scott Borgerson, who was her boyfriend and now maybe is her husband. And you were like, holy shit, I know this guy. I've interviewed this guy. And, you know, you called me up and sort of downloaded the data into my brain. So I wrote a piece about that, which it was on the site long before the New York Times knew anything about him, which was wonderful. I think it was the only time I've scooped the New York Times. So thank you. But
yes,
why don't you tell everybody about this guy? Cause you met him. And again, he's now kind of a key figure in this, one of the crimes of the century kind of situation. So
And a shadowy one too. He's been very smart. He has not spoken to the media at all. So I feel just dumb luck that I, you know, sat in the same room with him for a bit. So the story behind Scott is that, you know, my book came out, and it's funny. There's this strange thing that happens maybe to all writers, maybe just to female writers, maybe to female writers who write maritime books. I don't know. The pool is getting smaller and smaller here, but the phenomenon is that men, and only men, no judgment, reached out to me and they wanted me to write their biographies, mm-hmm. and or autobiographies, or maybe ghostwrite their biographies or whatever it was. And so this started happening a lot. And so the first person actually to reach out to me was the former mayor of Miami, and his name was Phil Levine. And we ended up sitting down and having coffee, and he made it very clear that he was interested in that. And I was like, sure. It wasn't something that I was going to do because I don't do that kind of thing. But, you know, that was the beginning of this phenomenon. Now, after Jeffrey Epstein killed himself, I just used air quotes there, folks. Yep. It turned out that Epstein had 13 numbers, contact numbers, for reaching this guy, Phil Levine. So he seems to have been somehow involved with all of that as well. I mean, that little black book.
Yeah.
That journalist got a hold of. I don't know. You heard about that, but I mean, somebody got a hold of that little black book.
I forget who it was, but no, you could go through and see who was in there. Simon LeBon is in there. It's really disappointing to me personally.
Oh, I'm so sorry, Greg. Are you a Duran Duran fan?
I am. Yeah.
I'm sorry about that too. Okay. Yeah, anyway. Okay. So the next person to reach out to me was this guy, Scott. And it turned out that Phil and Scott knew each other. And Scott said, hey, you know, I'm an entrepreneur. I'm former Coast Guard. I'm here in Boston. I'd love to talk to you. You know, would you like to come in? And I, because I'm a journalist, you know, I chase down every lead, right? If it sounds interesting. So I hopped on the train and went down, and I met with this guy. And of course, at the time, nobody had any idea his relationship to any of this.
Right.
But my impression of him, you know, being here in Boston, and I'm sure a lot of other places too, but you kind of know that tech bro profile, right? They're always trying to sell you something. There's a lot of hyperbole and hype about what they're up to. And, you know, they talk really fast. They throw a lot of acronyms and other things around. And obviously they're really passionate about what they're doing, but they're also always in raising money mode and raising PR mode. So that was my first takeaway. I was like, okay, tech bro, that's fine. But what he was doing was really, really, really compelling. And if he can pull off what he intends to pull off, what he said he was trying to do, it could make people incredibly wealthy. It could also help people do all kinds of super nefarious things. So I'm happy to tell you about what he told me about what his company does. If you think folks would be interested.
I think folks would be interested to hear what Ghislaine Maxwell's maybe husband, Scott Borgerson, is up to. Yes.
Okay, great.
Please do.
happy to do this. So his company is called Cargometrics, and I believe he started it, I would say, about 8 or 10 years ago. Here's the deal. Every commercial ship in the world carries something called AIS, which is like GPS, but for ships. And so the idea is that they report their location, it pings off a satellite, and then there are these aggregators, there are websites where you can geolocate any ship, any commercial ship in the world. And it's really quite amazing. So there's this website called marinetraffic.com. There's another one called Vessel Tracker. And anybody can go onto these websites. It's really quite amazing. And I mean, as I'm speaking, there are 50,000 large ships out there right now carrying everything under the sun, right? Some of the ships are cargo ships. So they've got those big containers on them. Some of them have thousands of containers on them. And others are what are called bulk carriers. So they're carrying all kinds of things. They might be carrying grain. They might be carrying cobalt. They might be carrying oil or, you know, you name it. So here's the deal. We can track the ships.
Right.
But we don't know what's on the ships.
Hmm.
And even a captain of a ship doesn't get a complete manifest. So a captain could like sail across the sea with, you know, thousands of boxes on his or her ship and look out at those boxes and you just have no idea what's inside.
Right.
And just about, this might have changed, but maybe 1% or less than 1% of those boxes, those containers, those huge containers are actually, you know, investigated, are actually, you know, checked by anybody.
Sure.
You know, in port, because they're packed somewhere else, they're brought to the port, and then they're loaded on and it just like, get the hell out of there. Because as long as you're in port, you're not making money. So Scott's idea was, is there a way to figure out what's on all those ships? And if I can do that, then I can use that information to start making bets about global markets.
Mm.
So we're talking about, you know, futures and shorts and all the stuff that I try not to know too much about because my brain is already stuffed with useless information. But,
You
know, that's one way to use this information. So if you know that there is a lot of, you know, raw material X going to country Y, you could make all kinds of bets about commodities or what that country is up to. That's kind of the idea. And from what I understand, he had a hedge fund that was supposed to be working with this data to try to make all kinds of bets and make people rich. That's a great idea. That's a really, really great idea. It almost feels like cheating because it just seems like if you could crack that code, that'd be really easy. But the only way that you can really crack that code is by being able to crunch a huge amount of data. And Amazon now makes it possible. You know, you can actually use their servers just like their supercomputers, you know, and crunch tons and tons and tons of data. So the question is, you get the data in, you're crunching the data. How do you organize that data to make it useful? And that's basically what he was offering, from my understanding, to private investors. So if I were a private investor, I could say what I'm really interested in is understanding, you know, grain movement or iron ore movement or whatever. And you could start to get a global picture of what the heck was going on. Can you understand? Does that make sense? Like, does that?
No, that it makes total sense. I'm trying to think of other applications for this and why someone like Ghislaine Maxwell would be interested in it, which would be, this is what's off the top of my head. You have thought of this, so you'll know a better thing. But like, if there was a situation where you really did know what was on all the ships, it would make the job of customs much easier because they wouldn't have to inspect certain things, only other things. And then they could basically conceal whatever it is they were smuggling through the software. They could just,
yeah, you think?
They could put a backdoor into the software and be like, oh, this ship has grain. These boxes have grain on it. And in fact, they don't have grain on it. They have, you know,
arms,
assault weapons or, I don't know.
Well, so you're definitely on the right track. I'm not saying that he would ever do this. I'm not saying that this is a thing. But
No. We don't want to even dare to impugn the guy whose moral compass is so wonderful that he's been with Ghislaine Maxwell. We would never.
Hey, who knows if he knew anything about her background? Right. She's just this like sexy, hot, you know, older British woman. Yeah. We'll get
Tech
to that.
Tech Bro doesn't know how to use Google. News at 11.
Well, I mean, how much information was really out there, you know, about Ghislaine until the whole Jeffrey Epstein thing blew up? Like, you could look up her father. You could say, okay, it's not a great family, but how much do we really know about her?
I don't know. It depends on when they got together. I mean, she's been in the Epstein stuff has been out for a long time. So,
yeah, but yeah. I mean, from what I understand, the one case that she was implicated in was probably sealed, right? The one in Florida back in 2008.
Yeah.
You know, Jeffrey, it seems, was able to protect her. So I don't know how much was actually out there. But yeah, so the point is, why would Ghislaine and Scott be interested in each other? I mean, I have so many theories, but I think one of the strongest is just that, you know, she is very, very good at grooming people, right? That's something that she does extremely well. She did it with Jeffrey Epstein. You know, he was just, from what I understand, he was socially awkward, rather nerdy, maybe a little insecure. And she was able to kind of bring him out, you know, into finer company, and, you know, help him out. And it's funny when you look at the early videos of him at parties where you see like Trump and other people, you can tell from his body language that he was an awkward kind of guy. He was, he was a little smaller, you know, he must have been a math genius from what I understand, but I don't think he wasn't glitzy like those folks. That wasn't his world. He's from Brooklyn and he, you know, he very much wanted to be that, but I could see him. I could see Ghislaine, who was very much a part of that, you know, and very well versed in all that, just being able to burnish his image, if you will. And then, you know, it's funny because very few people talk about the fact that then she was married to the Gateway guy, right? You know who I'm talking about.
I don't know who you're talking about.
So the guy who founded, do you remember Gateway Computers with the cow?
South Dakota. He lives.
Okay.
They're based in South Dakota, right? Gateway. Yeah.
I mean, are they still even around?
No, I don't think they're still around. There's the cow, so, South Dakota, Gateway. I can't remember his name. Sure.
So why isn't anybody talking about this? So after Jeffrey Epstein, she was married to the Gateway guy, and I apologize to him. I am blanking his name, but she did the same thing with him. So he was a very smart, nerdy tech guy. He founded this company, probably had a lot of money, and she groomed him. And, you know, at first he was some kind of like five hairs pulled back into a ponytail kind of, you know, schmucky looking guy. And, you know, then he transformed, bought a boat, a yacht, because I think she really likes oceans. And then things fell apart. I'm not sure why they fell apart. And then almost immediately she found Scott. So I think that there's a trend here, you know, smart, nerdy guys who really could use that shine and polish and introduction to fancy world. Because it's exciting, right?
Yeah.
But also with Scott, I think, as I said from the very beginning, I think he was really interested in raising money. And he did mention to me that he specifically used the word oligarchs, that, you know, he was flying around the world meeting with all kinds of folks. And oligarch is a judgment term, right? It's not like... Yeah. It's not like you can put that on a business card. So, you know, that he was tossing around with me the term oligarch, like I'm meeting with oligarchs in Turkey and Greece, said to me that, you know, it was a thrill for him. And maybe Ghislaine was helping connect him to some of these folks who could invest in his company and take advantage of what he was offering.
Very interesting. Isn't he really tall? He's kind of strapping.
Do you think he's strapping?
I don't know. I don't remember. I haven't studied the.
So he's 6'5"? He's big.
Yeah. Just trying to, you know, just throwing the data points out, trying to put the puzzle pieces together and thinking about the movement of things. I think we should point this out. The flow of stuff from port A to port B is basically, you know, that's what the mob does. That's what organized crime lives on. Obviously, plenty of legitimate businesses also live on it, but organized crime needs logistical operations to function. Otherwise, the heroin can't get from Afghanistan to where it's going. The cocaine can't come up from South America. The people can't come over from wherever they're bringing them in from. The guns can't come from here and there. They need the logistics. They need the ships.
Absolutely.
You know,
did you ever read Gomorrah?
No.
About the Italian mafia. So it's the opening scene in Gomorrah is just something I will never forget. And it takes place in Naples, at the port in Naples. And I don't know if this actually happened. I guess it probably did. But a crane was loading a container onto a ship, and somehow the container burst open and all these corpses fell out onto the deck of the ship. And it turns out that the Chinese workers who had been shipped over from China to Italy to make I'm not going to say Prada, but you know, the fine made in Italy goods at cut rates.
Right.
They made a deal with the mafia or with the mob or whatever, that they would, that their remains when they died would be repatriated to China. And this is how it was being done.
Wow.
In shipping containers. So, I mean, I have to hope that they didn't die in the shipping containers, that these were just bodies of people who had died. And they were very unceremoniously being repatriated to China.
Yeah. Now the mafia would never, they would never, you know, do anything.
They would never do
like
that, right?
Yeah. No. Have you been to Naples, by the way?
I have not. I've been to Italy a couple times, but not to Naples. How about you?
I went to Naples. We were there for like half a day on our honeymoon, and my people are from there. My Italians are from the Naples area. There's a town called Soma, which is on a volcano. You know, talk about a bad real estate idea. Maybe don't, you know, build your house on the side of
a
volcano. Yeah, very.
Look at the prices. Cheap.
My grandfather used to drive. He drove like a maniac all the time, and I never, you know, in this little quiet New Jersey suburb where we lived. And then I went to Naples, and I was like, okay, now I see why he drives like this, because I've never been more terrified than in the cab driver, you know, in the cab in Naples with the guy just careening around like there was just no tomorrow, and it was terrifying.
Well, it's funny because actually, let me just add this. So part of my research for my book, I took a container ship from Italy to the United States, and the container ship was an Italian ship. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up getting a bunch of stories from the captain and the mates. And and they were telling me about Naples and how insane it is. It sounds like it's just one big illegal drug bazaar in the center of the city, that like there's just one area where you just don't go because it's just everybody's just dealing drugs out in the open all the time. I don't know. That's what they told me.
I mean, I did not do that on my honeymoon, so I don't know. I can neither confirm nor deny.
We
took the boat to Ischia,
like,
where you know that sort of thing was not happening.
It wasn't,
but
like
I wouldn't
an
be surprised.
Airbnb, you know, like special towards the drug tour through Naples.
Yeah, it'll be like, yeah, that's perfect. You know, bored American. Let's show me the seedy underbelly of Naples. Yeah, that's like a bad movie introduction right there. You know,
I can totally see it. Why is it so easy for me to see?
Because it's like every third movie on like Hulu is that, you know, it's some,
oh my God,
you know, dumb Americans in places where they should not be.
Okay, it could be just about anywhere.
Exactly. Okay, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back with Rachel Slade.
It's where you learned.
At least 83.
Trump is a Russian asset.
That it's time to establish a direct contact with Donald Trump.
January 6th was never just a political rally.
An insurrection, an attempted overthrow of the federal government.
The origins of coronavirus.
Accidental leak, non-intentional, of a laboratory that was doing research on these viruses.
How the Crown covered up child abuse.
The vast majority of those people never imagined for one moment they were effectively participating in the concealment of child abuse, but they did.
Rudy is probably in violation of a FARO law, and the truth about Jeffrey Epstein.
If he was sleeping around this all the time, he made sure these girls were activated.
I'm Zev Shalev. Join me at Narrative. It's where truth lives, at narrative.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
There is a world beneath our own, created over a century ago by America's original gangsters. Meyer Lansky, Lucky Luciano, Al Capone. And it was infiltrated almost immediately by the world's most formidable spies. The new podcast, The World Beneath, illuminates the untold 100-year history of mobsters and spies. Listen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your shows.
Okay, we're back with Rachel Slade, author of Into the Raging Sea. We just covered a bunch of things. I'm moving on my list. I want you to talk about a subject near and dear to your heart, which is the Jones Act, something that is actually not just one act. It's a couple. So you'll explain this, because people listening either know exactly what it is or have never heard of it before. And once you hear it and kind of understand it a little bit, it pops every time you read about it in a news story, I have noticed.
It's true.
So first of all, what is the Jones Act? Why is it important, and why should we be for it or against it?
Yeah, actually, this is where I had to school you, because So the Jones Act is actually it's kind of a misnomer. It generally refers to a law from 1920, which says that any ship that moves goods between American port and American port must be owned by an American company. It must be, the ship itself must be built in America, and it must be, if possible, crewed by Americans. I just want to say before we get into this that this actually, we call it the Jones Act. It's based on the 1920 law, but this is actually one of the oldest laws in America. It was one of the first laws in America. It was part of Alexander Hamilton's whole, like, get this country, get the commerce and the industry and all that together really fast so we can start collecting taxes and protect our own industry against, you know, the much more mature economies of, you know, France and England and all those others. So this is not a unusual law for mature economies. Everybody wants to protect their shipping, because the idea is, well, there are a number of reasons, and one reason is economic, but the other reason is actually defense. So the defense argument is a little easier for me to talk about, because it's just so obvious. So we have a Navy, obviously.
We do.
But the Navy is actually kind of small, and in some ways highly specialized. We have these, like, really crazy expensive ships like the Zumwalt. You can look it up when you get off. Which actually has rail guns or something like that, which I understand have never worked. But anyway, these are like multi-billion dollar ships. And we have one or two that maybe function. So the Navy has a few, like, very highly specialized ships. But if we're really going to protect American interests on the ocean, you actually need much more than these specialized ships. You need kind of a whole Navy. And forevermore, ever since this country was founded, we've relied on commercial ships to fill in the gaps that our standing Navy doesn't have. So, you know, starting from the very beginning, commercial ships were actually commandeered to help fight the American Revolution, the War of 1812, all the way up to World War II, the Vietnam War. You need commercial ships doing the hard stuff. Okay. Like moving arms, moving men, women, and supplies. So the Jones Act guarantees that we actually still have a commercial shipping industry, right?
Right.
That is ours. That isn't Switzerland's or Norwegians. It's ours. We own it. They're Americans, and they're dedicated to the American cause. And so if we ever, God forbid, have to fight somebody else, we can turn to our fellow Americans and say, hey, you've got a bunch of ships. Can we use those? And they will, we hope, say yes. And then we have a whole bunch of people who are trained and who do this day in and day out. They know the shipping industry, right? And because they're doing it, they're actively doing it. So they're ready they're ready. And I also want to mention that actually during World War II, the U.S. Merchant Marine, now remember, they're civilians, but the U.S. Merchant Marine lost more men per capita than any of the armed forces.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
Yeah.
I did not know.
Because they were sailors, they were mariners, and they were basically enlisted, kind of. They were hired by the American military to sail these very slow moving ships across the Atlantic and across the Pacific to provide supplies for those wars. And they're slow ships. And sometimes they didn't even have like any kind of Navy backup. And so they were perfect targets for U-boats and German air and Japanese torpedoes. And
sort of sitting ducks.
Yeah, they were sitting ducks.
So you mentioned all that, which I didn't know. And it's also, it makes sense too, that we don't want foreign ships owned by God knows who going up the Mississippi into from one town to the next that without anybody knowing who's on the ship, where it comes from. Is it you know, you could smuggle nuclear weapons in. God knows what could happen. So I think, I mean, that's part of it too, right? The, you know, not having these foreign owned vessels right in a port, is that part of it?
Yeah, I mean, obviously on our coast, we have foreign vessels coming and going all the time. But yeah, that's right. On the interior, when you're talking about the Great Lakes, hello, huge shipping industry up there, or you're talking about the Mississippi River, absolutely. Like, you want to know who's there and you want to be able to protect your interior waterways. So it's a very, very important law from a defense perspective. And then there's the economic perspective, and that's a little more complicated, but it's not when you start to understand how the Koreans and the Chinese, and I guess to a certain extent, the Japanese, have really, through controlling shipping and controlling shipping costs, have been able to really push their exports into the United States and other major markets like this. You know, in Korea, the shipping industry is basically state-owned and state-run. It's more complicated than that, but it's essentially that. And it's the same in China, right? It's essentially state-owned, state-run. And that means that, you know, they can keep prices super cheap. And as soon as shipping gets cut down to almost nothing, the cost of shipping, that's when Americans started offshoring so many parts of our supply chain, and actually sometimes entire manufacturing started to get done overseas because shipping was cheap, super right. cheap.
Interesting.
And so, you know, because we offshored so much, we gave away a lot of intellectual property. You know, when you allow the Chinese or whatever to make your product from soup to nuts, from beginning to end, then they know how to do that and they can copy that. And then, you know, when they're subsidizing all of their shipping industry, then they can send it back to you for no cost at all. And that means we don't got nothing to do anymore. We're not making things anymore,
right.
which is what my next book is about.
Right. We're going to get to that. We're going to end on that, because I can't I can't wait for that book. I'm really excited about it. So in the town where I live in upstate New York, when we first moved there, okay, I would read the local paper to try to figure out what the deal was with local politics. And there was this one guy, this local business owner, who was such an obvious buffoonish asshole, selfish dick, even though everybody in the town is a Democrat, right? So you can't go by political party. You have to go by what. So it would get to the point where I could tell if he was for something, whatever it was, I know that I was opposed to it. So this is the thing about the Jones Act, which I found fascinating, is that all the rich people want to get rid of the Jones Act. Like, every time you go on Twitter and write about the Jones Act, there's some dude whose job it is to find your threads and just try to refute them. Because
the Cato Institute guy. Yeah.
It's like his job.
It is, actually. No, it is.
Sail the waters of the internet looking for people that dare speak ill of the Jones Act. And it's like, if the opponents of this are that well funded, I mean, that's a little bit scary, I guess. So, you know, I feel like it's an analogous situation.
It's interesting because, yeah, so you're talking about the Cato Institute guy, and he's very much there. It's amazing. He just pops up. Like, that is his full-time job. But fortunately, this is, at the moment, I think, well, it's a very union strong industry, American shipping right now. And, you know, the unions are constantly lobbying to ensure that this thing doesn't go away. And fortunately, there are a lot of, I'm surprised I'm going to say this, but there are a lot of very smart people in DC who really understand the defense of the Jones Act. Like, they really, really get it. And they would never, ever get rid of the Jones Act. And now, fortunately, you know, with Biden in power, who's very, very pro-labor, I don't think he would ever consider getting rid of the Jones Act. Also, I can tell you, Ron Klain, who is his chief of staff, did read Into the Raging Sea. He was one of my first fans. We had a little Twitter back and forth. So I know that he's very well aware of the problems with the American shipping industry right now, what it's facing, but also, you know, the importance of the Jones Act. So I think we have a very Jones Act friendly administration, and there are a lot of smart people who just will let folks talk about how expensive it is for Americans and American shippers to have to deal with this regulatory piece of legislation, but, you know, ultimately they can shut the hell up. I think.
Amen. I think. Now, speaking of people in Washington who feel some way and have some power over the shipping industry, Elaine Chao. Elaine Chao is the sister of the woman who now runs her father's company, which is one of the largest shipping concerns in China, like plugged into the Chinese government. As you mentioned, Chinese shipping is heavily regulated, if not outright just controlled by the communist Chinese government there. Can I do that? Are we allowed to do? Can we get our Tucker Carlson on the communist Chinese government? but in all seriousness, you know, these people are very connected to high levels of Chinese government. That's Elaine Chao's family business. She is, first of all, married to Mitch McConnell, whose net worth skyrockets as soon as he gets married because, you know, now he's married into wealth. And also, she's the fucking Secretary of Transportation. Like,
yeah.
How big of a conflict? Is that the biggest conflict of interest of all time? Like, where does it rank? I don't know. Tell us about Elaine Chao.
So in the Trump administration, was that the biggest conflict of interest? No. And if you're talking about shipping, you know, you also want to talk about Wilbur Ross, because he didn't give up any of his shipping interests while he was, you know, he was Secretary of Commerce, right? So, on the scale of head scratcher, maybe this person shouldn't be making decisions about this particular thing. It's interesting because I actually spoke to the former director of MARAD, which is on the Maritime Administration, which fell under the Department of Transportation and kind of controls a lot of what we're talking about right now. And she was actually seen as pretty damn competent in the Department of Transportation, but that's not to say that she wasn't cutting certain deals or throwing her weight around maybe in China and in the shipping industry in general to just get small favors done. I think, you know, from what I understand from my sources, during the Trump administration, there were two camps. There was the anti-Jones Act camp. And then there was the camp that was absolutely convinced that we were about to get into a war with China. And I don't know where people stand now in terms of, is China really a military threat? But I think that shapes your worldview when you're talking about what's happening on the high seas.
Yeah.
Because China generally, and again, the high seas, like we have a tendency to just sort of be like, oh, that's that thing, right? It's water and it's out there, it's beyond our shores. Like, but, you know, China has been very, very active in basically trying to control ports around the world and bodies of water around the world. And their circle of influence, their sphere of influence continues to grow and grow and grow, especially when we're talking about in the Pacific. So Elaine Chao, I mean, we know from the New York Times report that, you know, she used her position of power to make introductions in China for her family's company. Mm-hmm. And I know that her family's company actually got major loans from China to construct ships in China, because that's where they were building the ships. So, I mean, was our security threatened by all that? I don't know. Maybe it just made everybody in her camp a little bit richer. Yeah. I guess what I'm saying is, I don't know if she or her family is actually a threat. I think what we have to think about a lot more is that economically, we are seriously, do you believe me? Are you going to believe me? We're seriously fucked if we don't really understand the implications of losing manufacturing.
See, now this is a good segue into the last thing, which is the book that you're writing. So I'm just thinking about if I should go back to the Chinese thing for a second, because
just to
hammer the point home that you were making. I mean, China's doing this new Silk Road thing where they're trying to expand basically their trade to everywhere. And as I understand it, they, you know, they control so much of global shipping in terms of percentage that there are issues now that people can foresee. Like they could, if they wanted to, much like how the Middle Eastern countries and OPEC can control the flow of oil, the Chinese could, if they wanted to, fuck everything up by just slowing down or curtailing the, you know, the global shipping. Not that they have any financial incentive to do that, but they could. And we know, you know, global shipping, as great as it is most of the time, all it takes is one bad turn in the Suez Canal and everything grinds to a halt. So exactly. I don't know.
So what's happened now is that the price of shipping is 3 times what it cost a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's really important to understand because that's going to affect the price of every single thing you buy. Because whether or not it's made in America, it's got components coming from all over the world.
Right.
And here's the deal. You know, we Americans pretty much gave up ocean shipping 40, 50 years ago. We don't really do that anymore. The only American ships left are Jones Act ships. So they're moving stuff from American port to American port. Most of them are not doing, you know, the international shipping that the Chinese are doing. So yeah, I mean, they do have us by the balls if, you know, if they decide to raise shipping rates. There just isn't a lot of competition out there. There's Maersk, which has some American ships. It's a Danish company. There are Korean companies, but for the most part, like, we're super dependent on Chinese shipping at this point. And that is exactly why the Jones Act was kind of burnished in revised in 1920, because during World War I, we had no shipping. America had no shipping. And all these countries, you know, all these European countries suddenly were, you know, embroiled in war, and our shipping costs went through the roof. So it became very expensive to import stuff and very expensive to export stuff. And when stuff is really expensive to export, nobody in the world can afford to buy your products anymore. Right. Even if your products are relatively cheap compared to everybody else's, they can't ship them. Shipping is such a key component to your cost, right? Which is actually why Amazon, like Jeff Bezos, they're really smart. Like, they're buying ships.
Yeah.
You know, you got to control this stuff or you can't be competitive. And here in America, we tend to say labor. It's the labor costs. Oh, labor and labor unions ruin America and everything else. But it's so much more complex than that. And shipping is a really big part of that cost. It used to be, and it's becoming again. So I think everybody should just be talking about shipping like all the time now. I mean, it's factored into the cost of everything. And, you know, I don't know if you saw, but inflation now is at 5%. We've experienced 5% inflation in the past year or something like that. I would argue that that's shipping. That's shipping right there. Yeah, again, I told you the cost of shipping has tripled.
Yeah, no, I know. I know from my own, you know, experiences with the stuff. And you're right. We have to make sure that if the goods can't go, that we have stuff here that we're making and manufacturing, because then we're screwed. I mean, the only thing that's helping us is the fact that if China is going to stop shipping out stuff, their economy is going to collapse also. So it's almost, in my probably naive thinking, I mean, I don't think they have much financial incentive to crush us, because we buy all their shit. Like, you know, if we don't, it doesn't really make, you know, that much sense. But this all comes back to, you say shipping, but it also comes back to manufacturing and where manufacturing is and why manufacturing went offshore to begin with, which is, that's what your new book is about. And it's so fascinating. So tell us a little bit about that, if you don't mind.
Yeah. So actually, I mean, it started, of course, when I was researching El Faro, which was the ship that went down. But then when I was working at The Globe, I ended up publishing a piece by Catherine Eben. So she's a fantastic journalist. And she had put out a book. And this is before COVID. And it was all about...
No, this is Catherine Eben, right? From Vanity Fair? She's been on this podcast, Rachel.
Oh, she's great. She's wonderful. So you know.
She's fantastic.
She's the best. And so then you know that 90% of all of our pharmaceuticals were being made in China and India. So, you know, I read that and I was like, this sounds like it could be problematic. And then COVID, right? So here I am, you know, I wrote the book the book came out in 2018. Catherine's piece, I worked with her in 2019. So this is all pre-COVID, but I'm thinking, shit, man. Like, there are a lot of things here that could add up to one major problem for all of us. You know, between the shipping and the manufacturing, if any one of these things were to somehow get screwy, we would be up Schitt's Creek. And then the pandemic comes. And it turns out, not only do we not have drugs and reagents to make drugs ourselves, right? I mean, that's the problem too.
Right.
Is that to make drugs, you need ingredients. And so we don't have the basic ingredients. We don't have the facilities to make the drugs. And I apologize if Catherine has already talked about this.
No. No, we talked about the Kushner stuff. Yeah.
Oh, okay, great. Okay. Yeah. Wow. Okay, so we have a drug shortage. Because the ships aren't coming. I mean, whoa. And then we can't make our own protective clothing, right? Yeah. We can't make masks. So in early 2020, you know, when the shit is like halfway through the fan, sorry, that's very visual, but Etsy, you know, Etsy, like the craft site, they put out a call to all of their sewers. I don't know if you know this. And they said, if you have a sewing machine and fabrics just lying around, could you please make some masks and sell them on Etsy? Because people need masks and they don't have them. Etsy,
saving the day. Saving the day.
I mean, they are appealing to not to generalize, but middle-aged women, you know, hippies, anybody with a sewing machine.
I remember the pictures. Yeah. Yeah. People like, yeah.
I mean, it was like World War II with a victory garden. Like, please, ladies and men, anybody with a sewing machine, if you got some fabric in your goddamn closet, like pull it out, cut it up and start making masks for Americans. Like it was insane. And because a lot of companies that were equipped to do this just shut down, right?
Yeah.
Because we do have apparel manufacturers in America, but they, you know, everything was shut down, but people could do things in their living room or whatever, their craft room. And so then suddenly there was this shortage of elastic in America.
Yeah.
Because, you know, to sew these things, you needed the elastic that went around the ear. And there was a serious supply issue because you've got a few companies now committed to making PPE. Like they're going to try to stay open. They're going to try to protect their workers as best they can. They were making apparel before. Now they're making PPE. They're making masks. They're making gowns. They're figuring out how to do it. They're retooling their factories. And you've got all these individuals, you know, with their sewing machines like, oh, you know, I'll chip in. And now there's no elastic in America.
That's
because
crazy.
There's no built-in supply chain for this kind of thing, right? It's a totally broken supply chain because we haven't been making shit for so long.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Right?
I mean,
if
that's not really a wake-up call, basic. I don't know what is, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, before that, I was one of those people from a very early age. I was so obnoxious. I remember my grandmother coming back from Europe. And she had bought me a doll when I was really, really little. I probably had just learned how to read and I flipped the doll over and I go, weird, you know, you bought this in whatever, Paris. and it's made in China. Yeah, I was that kid. Or Japan, wherever it was made. It was probably made in Japan because we're talking about, I'm very, very old. So, and I remember my parents looking around like, oh God, our kid is so obnoxious. When can we get rid of her? Which goes back to the truck behind you. My parents tried to kill me many times with our very dangerous 1970s or whatever toys. But yeah, so I've been thinking about this for a long time. Like, why don't we make stuff? And isn't a problem that we don't make stuff? And how are we gonna make stuff again? And can we do it the right way this time? Because there have been moments in American history that have been almost utopian when it comes to manufacturing. There have been moments when the people who got the capital together to pull together factories and machines and all the infrastructure that you need to make things, when those people were sympathetic to the people who were running the machines. There have been a few moments in history when the operators and the owners were simpatico.
Yeah.
And so what fascinates me, and obviously that this is going to be explored in the book, are those moments when it was really working beautifully, and then why did it all go to shit?
Yeah. So why does it break apart? What are the forces at work? Why does the government decide to do this? Because a lot of this it doesn't happen out of the blue. It happens because of certain governmental policies, which is stuff you're going to talk about in the book, right? Do you have a title yet, by the way?
I'm using the adventures of one small company to help to kind of guide us through all of the trials and tribulations of what it's like to make things in 2021 in America.
Okay.
And so right now my working title is American Hoodie, because they make hoodies.
Right.
And the hoodie itself is a fascinating object to me. I feel like, it's an American icon.
Yeah.
It is fully homegrown. And I'm going to talk about in the book. But just kind of the origin story of the hoodie itself, and then what it symbolizes has changed over time.
Absolutely.
So, you know, you can think of on the waterfront, you've got Marlon Brando with his hoodie, right? So it was a working man's thing, right? Mm-hmm. That's what the guys on the docks wore. And then you've got like Rocky, you know, running up the Philly steps. I'm from Philly, running up the Philadelphia Museum of Art steps in his hoodie. That hoodie, that wow, working man's hoodie, right? It was warm. It had a hood. You didn't always have to wear the hood. It's great. I think it's actually the most perfect article of clothing ever invented by man or woman. And then you have hip hop in the 90s,
right.
Which adopted the hoodie. And then you have the awful, awful, awful Trayvon Martin story, where you have young, usually black kids, right, getting attacked because they're wearing a hoodie,
right?
And I don't know if you remember, but after his death, after his murder, there was a ton of dialogue about like, you know, schools banning hoodies.
Yeah, I remember.
Kids shouldn't wear hoodies, and you know, parents telling their kids like, don't put the hood up. And you know, there were signs on banks that said like, if you have a hood, take it down. And because it seemed like a way that you could obscure who you were, right? That
right.
You could.
Sure.
So it's kind of it's so very American, because it's been co-opted by so many different groups, but it's also, it's just perfect article of clothing. You can unzip it when you're hot. You can put the hood up, you can take it off. So this company makes hoodies,
you know,
among other things.
I'm also old, and we used to call these things sweatshirts when I was coming up, whether or not
really?
I had a hood. Yeah, it's a sweatshirt.
Oh.
It's not a hoodie. I didn't start calling it a hoodie until like 2 years ago. This is a sweatshirt. Sorry. The group that you missed is the tech bro CEO guys, you know, Zuckerberg hoodie and
yes,
the guy
you.
On Billions in his hoodie, which means that also, like you said, it's come from a place or a very working class thing into an upper class thing, or at least a cool upper class thing, where an artifact of clothing or an object of clothing has been basically appropriated by one class from another class.
Yeah.
Similar to jeans, you know, like the same thing happened
yes.
with jeans. Like jeans used to be like working class, and then like all the, you know, the rock band people wore jeans, and now my kids won't wear jeans because they're too formal. That's where we're at now. It's just that it's too formalized.
What do you wear?
Old people, they wear, I call them sweatpants, but they're joggers or whatever.
Oh. Good to know. Thank you for the tip. yeah. Well, it's funny because my daughter, so this is funny. My daughter just bought a whole bunch of things with her grandma, who she hadn't seen in like almost 2 years because of COVID. And so she got this like pile of jeans, but every single one of them has these enormous holes in them.
Oh my right? God.
And they're really expensive.
Yeah.
So I always wonder, like, you know, that woman in Bangladesh whose job it is to just destroy the pair of jeans for the American market. What are they thinking?
Yeah, they must hate us so much. It's so dumb. It's you know, I have jeans. Once the jeans rip, they're useless because your knee pops out and it's just, it's not a good, you know, I know there's style is best when form and function converge, in my opinion.
Thank you.
That's why the hoodie is such a wonderful artifact, as you say, because it looks cool, but it's also warm. You can zip it. You can unzip it. If it's raining, you put the hood over your head.
Exactly.
I like cargo pants. I like cargo pants for the same reason. There's pockets in my pants. And they don't, you know. Yeah. It, you know, it's a good thing.
You know what's funny about the ripped jeans is that when you have multiple huge rips, as her jeans have in them, she's going to kill me. They're really hard to put on.
Yes. Yep. Yep.
Right? Because you keep putting your foot through the hole.
And then they tear more. And then you go have to buy more jeans. It's really a great idea for these companies.
So putting these on is actually an art. She's going
to
kill me.
Well, it used to be back in the day, you know, people used to wear those tight jeans that used to have pliers to pull the zipper up. So.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, jeans.
There's always a little bit of suffering for beauty. You know,
of course. I mean, you don't suffer for beauty. There's something wrong with you. But yeah, so I'm fascinated with the hoodie and I'm fascinated with this company. They actually started based on ideology rather than interest in making a specific thing. They wanted to prove, it's a young couple, they wanted to prove that capitalism could be a force of good and build community. Like, they really wanted to recreate that utopian ideal, which very much started here in New England. And that's what they're doing. And so far they've lifted 70 families out of poverty in a town where there used to be industry, there is none now. They're building something. And I'm really rooting for them, but I'm also just rooting for all of us. I think, you know, we have, we rediscovered food, right?
Yeah.
Like 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Like we started, or maybe it was longer, but we started to care about, hey, who's growing my food? Where is it grown? How is it grown? And I'm really hoping that we start to think much more about the things that we put next to our skin. Like how much more intimate could that be?
Yeah.
Right?
It's true.
You know, and you think about like the power of clothing. Like when you think about, for example, Orthodox Jews and the tallis, which is, for folks who don't know, you know, it's the prayer shawl. And if you're a certain sect of Jewish, then you actually like put that prayer shawl like right next to your skin.
Yeah.
But that's what we're doing all day long. When we put clothing onto our bodies, we're coming in contact with the whole process of making, right? The fibers, the weaving, the dyes, and the actual stitching of these objects. Like, who made them? Where are they coming from? We should care. We should care.
Well, not only that, but going back to the idea of a utopia, if we can bring back manufacturing to America, which high shipping and some sort of governmental policy to make it so, and a push to, for purposes of defense even, and self-sustaining, putting those places... You know, if Jeff Bezos, say, decided I'm going to create this company that sells clothes now, and I'm going to put one factory in Wyoming, and I'm going to put one in South Dakota, and I'm going to put one in Oklahoma, say, people will move there. The population will go up. And if it's all these labor and union jobs, maybe those states turn blue and we don't have the goddamn, you know, logjam in the fucking Senate. Like we have, there's lots of ways that this could be good for, not just for clothes, and it, good for everything, and you know, improve the situation on the ground a little bit.
Absolutely. You know, it's funny because I just joined the Boston Athenaeum and they have crazy documents, you know, from the 1700s. They have this just phenomenal collection of just weird things. And I found a treatise from, or a pamphlet, they call it, from 1753, where this guy is saying, oh my God, Boston, you know, it's filled with all these poor people and they don't have anything to do and they're wandering the streets and they're picking pockets and their children running around. And his solution was to create industry for them. So he wanted them to start making linen, growing linen, and, you know, weaving linen and making it into clothes. He was like, industry will save us. And this was before it was America, right? So this colonial times. And, you know, in America, we weren't, in North America, we weren't allowed to make things pretty much. The British were preventing us from creating industry, having manufacturing. Mm-hmm. We were not allowed to have manufacturing because they saw the colonies as a source of income. And so shouldn't it be extremely patriotic, extremely American to want to make things here by Americans? I mean, again, going back to the Jones Act and Alexander Hamilton, these were the first things that he really cared about. He was like, we need to make things here. We need to be independent. We need to have our own economy that's about buying, selling, and making. And then ultimately, maybe if we get lucky, we can start exporting things, but it starts here. We need to be self-sufficient. And there was a time when we were, and I don't know, I feel like now is as good time as any to try again. And for all those naysayers out there, by the way, who say, you can't compete on labor costs with El Salvador, Honduras, or China, or Cambodia, or Vietnam. Like, it's just ridiculous to try to make a t-shirt here or a hoodie here, or whatever it is. Guys, you are so very wrong, because there are already companies that have been doing that for years and years and years very successfully. It's not the labor costs anymore that's gonna kill us. It's much less of a factor now. It can be done. You just have to be very efficient. You have to do things right, but you can take care of people. And I'm going to show you how.
I'm very excited for this book. See, that was a very rousing speech. It's a good way to end the show here. What you're really saying is we want to build back up. We want to start having manufacturing here. We want to emphasize the make. In Make America Great Again. That's what we want to do. Make. Ooh. Yeah. We're going to have to come up with a better slogan, but something with make, though, you know?
Yeah.
Build back better. I'm actually build back better. I like that. Somebody should make that their slogan.
Right?
Yeah, it seems like it's a good one. So I'm excited for American Hoodie when it comes out. And your book is called Into the Raging Sea, which, again, I can't recommend highly enough. It's really, you know, it's just a magnificent work. When I finished reading it, I was like, I can't believe you did this. This is such a, as a writer and person, it's such an impressive accomplishment to follow through with that story. And the difficulty emotionally of that reporting and to produce what you produce is really, it's just fucking awesome. So,
wow, you know, great. Thank you so much.
I salute you. And, you know, I'm just stunned that you wrote something this good, honestly. Not that you did, but that anybody did. you know what I'm saying. Anyway.
Don't look like somebody who could do something like that.
Into the Raging Sea is your book. You also have written a couple pieces for me at Prevail. So check out Rachel Slade. Thank you so much for joining me. This has been fantastic.
Oh, I've had such a great time. Thank you, Greg.
The Prevail theme song is by Matthew Fassa. Sophia Tereshchenko provided the Russian introduction. Voice talent is provided by Tally Briggs, Signadella, Stephanie St. John, Brett Petticord, Ryan Byrne at History Falls Apart, and me. Thanks to Allison Gill, Molly Hawkey, Kanai Williams, and everyone else at MSW Media. Please subscribe to the Prevail website with updates every Tuesday, Friday, and Sunday. Your $5 monthly subscription funds the site and the podcast. Visit gregoliar.com to learn more. Thanks for listening. Drive safely. Don't forget to tip your server. Until next time, we shall prevail.
MSW. CW Media.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.